Sagrihitva Kare Krishna
Sagrihitva Kare Krishna
Upalabhya Hitai Shini
Upalabhya Hitai Shini
Yashoda Boya Samranta
Yashoda Boya Samranta
Prekshanaksham Abhashata
Prekshanaksham Abhashata
Sagrihitva Kare Krishna
Sagrihitva Kare Krishna
Upalabhya Hitai Shini
Upalabhya Hitai Shini
Yashoda Baya Samranta
Yashoda Baya Samranta
Prikshanaksham Abhashata
Prikshanaksham Abhashata
Mother Yashoda.
Mother Yashoda.
Grihitva.
Grihitva.
Taking.
Taking.
Kare.
Within the hands.
Being anxious about what Krishna might have eaten.
Being anxious about what Krishna might have eaten.
Krishna.
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 Upalabhya.
Wanted to chastise him.
Wanted to chastise him.
Hita Eshini.
Hita Eshini.
Because she was anxious for the welfare of Krishna.
Because she was anxious for the welfare of Krishna.
She became very much agitated.
She became very much agitated.
Thinking, how is it that Krishna has eaten earth?
Thinking, how is it that Krishna has eaten earth?
Yashoda. Mother Yashoda.
Mother Yashoda.
Baya Sambranta Prekshana Aksham.
Baya Sambranta Prekshana Aksham.
Began to look very carefully within Krishna's mouth in fear.
Began to look very carefully within Krishna's mouth in fear.
To see if Krishna had eaten something dangerous.
To see if Krishna had eaten something dangerous.
Abhashata,
Abhashata
began to address Krishna.
Began to address Krishna.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Upon hearing this from Krishna's playmates, Mother Yashoda, who was always full of anxiety over Krishna's welfare, picked Krishna up with her hands to look into his mouth and chastise him. Her eyes fearful, she spoke to her son as follows. No purport, I'll read the next verse. Kasmad vidam adant atman bhavan bhakshitavan raha vadanti tavaka hiete kumaraste grajopyayam. Dear Krishna, why are you so restless that you have eaten dirt in a solitary place? This complaint has been lodged against you by all your playmates, including your elder brother Balaram. How is this? Purport. Mother Yashoda was agitated by Krishna's restless misbehavior. Her house was full of sweetmeats. Why then should the restless boy eat dirt in a solitary place? Sorry. Krishna replied, "My dear mother, they have plotted together and lodged a complaint against me so that you will punish me. My elder brother Balaram has joined them. Actually, I have not done this. Take my words as true. Do not be angry and chastise me." Things should not be taken just superficially. Krishna is not just another cute boy. And you cannot substitute your own boy for Krishna. You know, some mundane person. You cannot equate Krishna with an ordinary person. Otherwise, we'd have to conclude that Krishna is not a very good person. He's a liar and a cheater. He causes so much trouble. we have to understand properly Krishna's nature. We need some philosophical background. There is the term Jnana Shunya Bhakti, devotion devoid of knowledge. But that should be properly understood. A devotee cannot be ignorant and be pure in his devotion to Krishna at the same time. Devotion has to be founded on proper philosophical understanding. This, again, this is a term used by Jiva Goswami, I presume, in the Sandarbhas. Where does this term Jnana Shunya Bhakti be used? Yes? Vishnu Chakravarti, yes. But I think Jiva Goswami before him used the term, and Sanatana Goswami. It's the more advanced stage of bhakti where one is no longer interested in the cultivation of knowledge. But it doesn't mean that there is no knowledge. Just like a person who has earned enough money can retire early. You know, if he's not greedy and just addicted to working and addicted to just money for its own sake, when he's earned enough, he can quit and just live on as much as he's earned so far. So similarly, a person in the beginning of his spiritual life must acquire essential knowledge. But when you've got enough of it, you can quit. Retire from the knowledge business. And then simply be concerned about what will make Krishna happy. And simply understand that what will make me happy is to always be thinking about Krishna and serving Krishna. I don't need to know anything else. And I learned so many things. I went to the public schools and they taught me geography and they taught me arithmetic and they taught me history of the world. And then I went to the university. I studied American and British and world literature, read so many books written by mundane people about mundane things. And I filled my head with all these things. And then I became a member of ISKCON and read the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam. And we're taught so many points of philosophy. But there comes a point, just like a boy finishes his education, now it's time to go out and get a job. You know, most people don't stay in school all their lives. Some do. But normally a person gets an education and then uses it. Like that, we get our basic spiritual education. Then we should put it to use in devotion. And when that devotion is pure of any irrelevant interest in the cultivation of knowledge, that's Jnana Shunya Bhakti. There is a foundation of knowledge. But you don't need any more. You have enough. You're satisfied. Okay, I'm convinced. Krishna is the Supreme Lord. I'm his devotee. And so many things I've learned about Krishna. Mother Yashoda is a perfect example. Jnana Shunya Bhakta. But to achieve that position, she performed strict sadhana, including the cultivation of all sorts of knowledge about Krishna. But that was in previous lives. In this life, she was born already perfect. And probably as a girl of the Vaishya community, she probably didn't get much education. Maybe she knows how to read. You know, but I'm sure she didn't study Shastras too much. You know, she didn't go to school for very long. She learned in her mother's kitchen what she learned and needed to learn. But actually, she did all that in her previous lives. She's not ignorant. Our devotion that's supposed to be void of knowledge is void of any more knowledge than you need. You already have enough when you've already finished your education. So we should understand that these pure devotees, they're not ignorant of Krishna's position. But they don't want to think about it. The influence of Yogamaya is such that Yogamaya helps the devotees ignore the fact that Krishna is the Supreme Lord so they can have an intimate relationship with him. But that's not based on ignorance. Otherwise, if we don't have that knowledge, that basic philosophical knowledge, we will misunderstand Krishna. We will think he's a cheat and a liar and a debauchee who runs after everybody's wives. And we would think that somebody who's like that, a cheater, a liar, and a woman hunter, is as good as Krishna. Or maybe we're like that, and we think we're as good as Krishna. We can fall into all sorts of delusions and abominable behavior if we don't understand Krishna properly. Or at least, even if we're decent people, we won't really rise much in spiritual life. We'll have some sentimental attachment to Krishna, but we won't understand how he's special. We'll think he's some great hero who's also a naughty boy on the side. What we need to rise above that very weak variety of devotion, to just be attracted to Krishna, but not understand who he is. We need to learn who he is. Krishna advises this. Janma karma cha me divyam evam yo veti tatvataha. One should understand scientifically, systematically, the special nature of Krishna's birth and activities. That's very general. What's special about Krishna? Not just some particular features, that he's blue and most of us aren't blue, that he plays the flute but I play the oboe and someone else plays the saxophone. You know, those are superficial differences. What makes Krishna different is much more basic than that. The very way that he's born and the very way he does everything he does is completely different than everybody else. Not just his color or what instrument he likes to play. Or he likes cows and I like dogs. You know, these are superficial differences. Krishna's birth is transcendental. His activities are all transcendental. He's never under the control of the modes of nature. Nature, Maya, is his maidservant. Therefore, she never has control over him. Therefore, his birth and his activities are totally free. We might be powerful persons because we have a lot of money and a lot of influence. We can do basically whatever we want. Can you die when you want? Can you decide when you're going to die? Only a few great yogis. Vanchitas tutara, yoginas chandamrityor. One who is chandamrityu is blessed with the power to decide when he's going to die. Bhishmadev was one of the few people in that category. And although he was a kshatriya, he's called a yogi in this case, because only a great yogi has the power to choose the time of his death. But it's possible for a few rare souls. But who has chosen how and when he's going to be born? That, how could a jiva do that? Because every jiva is put into ignorance. Time of death, you enter into the womb of your next mother, and you have no control over it, and you have no knowledge of the process, how you're being transported to your next body. You don't choose it, you don't even know what it's going to be. So I don't know if there's any yogi, any jiva, who can decide the time of his birth. I never heard of that. Or which birth he'll take. That's determined by others. So Krishna is different even than the yogis who can decide when they're going to die and how they're going to die. What was it? Some story about Birbal and Emperor Akbar. Birbal was sentenced to death for some reason. And he did something, you know, he's always getting into trouble. So the King Akbar, you know, sentenced him to death. Yeah. And I don't know the whole story. Anybody know the story? Why he was sentenced to death? Okay. Birbal was sentenced to die.
Something overly clever.
Did something too clever. The king threatened, said, okay, now you've done too much. I sentence you to death. But I'll give you one benediction, extenuating circumstance that you can choose how you're going to die. What's going to be the cause of your death? You come tomorrow morning and tell me, and we'll execute the sentence. So Birbal came to the court on the morning of his execution, and he didn't seem very upset. The king said, okay, what is your choice of means of death? And Birbal said, old age. So he was given the benediction to choose how he's going to die. But Krishna takes his birth according to his sweet will, where and how he wants, in what form and when. That's what's different about Krishna. Especially different about Krishna in Vrindavan. Krishna, his original form, appearing in Sri Vrindavan Dham, Vrajabhumi. He's not a liar, he's not a cheat, and he's not a woman hunter. We should understand him properly. His activities are all transcendental. The complaint is that Krishna has eaten dirt. And the Mother Yashoda is rightly concerned. She's not just on a control trip. That she's going to beat her son just for the heck of it. No, she's Hitaishini, is what the previous verse said. She's honestly concerned that this is not good. He might eat something that will make him sick. Who knows what is out there in the streets, and he's putting it into his mouth. Silly young children do this. But remember, Krishna's not an ordinary child. We shouldn't translate Krishna's lila into our own experience. It's not just Krishna's another boy, and boys are like that, and it's so fun to see the boys acting like boys. But Krishna's not an ordinary boy. We have to see deeper into it. In the normal circumstance, yes, the mother's upset. The boy has eaten dirt, and she slaps him back and forth, threatens him, and next you do it again, I'll hit you twice as hard, and that's the end of the story. That's the lila in the ordinary world. But here, with Krishna and his mother, it works out differently. The mood is different, and the dynamics are different. Yes, the complaint has been lodged that Krishna has eaten dirt. And it's probably true. And he's probably lying now to his mother, saying that it didn't happen. The boys are all lying. They're lying, and they're making false claims that I did this. I didn't do it. Look in my mouth and see. But the thing is, he's God. He can devour the whole universe without getting a stomach ache. A little bit of dirt from the backyard is not going to make him sick. He's different. And then, when Mother Yashoda, I don't want to give away the story, but when she looks in his mouth, she's going to see the whole universe in his abdomen. Everything within him. So Krishna can swallow a handful of dirt. He swallows the whole universe. Very wonderful pastime. And the most What's the most amazing thing about this pastime? Anybody?
She forgets everything within a second.
Yes. Not that Krishna has the whole universe in his abdomen. That's just ordinary for Krishna. But the wonderful thing is shown by his devotee Yashoda, her power, to forget that he's God. That 1 minute after seeing the universe, universal form of the whole universe within Krishna, she puts that aside and is again thinking about how Krishna, he can get sick. I have to chastise him, and I have to correct him, and I have to see that he doesn't get sick. She immediately returns to her motherly affection. That affection is so strong that even seeing right with her own eyes the whole universe in Krishna's body, that doesn't change her mood. She still thinks Krishna depends on her for protection. That's love, and that's the amazing thing in this pastime. Hare Krishna. We can't imitate this either. One fault is to be ignorant and to just think Krishna's activities are ordinary, like those of ordinary people. Another one is to think that we're not ordinary people, we're transcendental devotees, and we can imitate these intimate relationships with Krishna when we haven't even purified ourselves sufficiently to be called proper devotees. You know, we are still, you know, in some cases, a devotee is still full of material desires and maybe even indulging in illicit activities. And at the same time, he's presuming that he's on the level of the pure devotees of Vrindavan, that he can claim already his intimate relationship with Krishna. This is the other end of the spectrum. One end of the spectrum is just materialism and ignorance. And the other end of the spectrum is this sahaja tendency, to think that you're already very advanced, that don't worry about, you know, the dirt in my life. I can just sweep that under the rug and pretend I'm pure. And claim my relationship with Krishna when I haven't earned it yet. And think that I can behave like Krishna the way Mother Yashoda behaves with him, or the way the gopis behave with him. You know, this is also very, very dangerous. Then devotional service becomes something of an abomination or an embarrassment. When one is pretending to be very advanced when he's not even basically up to the standard yet. Shruti Smriti Purana Adi Pancharatriki Vidim Vina Aikantiki Hariya Bhaktir Utpatayava Kalpate. Devotional service in practice, that's what we're doing. Most of us. Maybe someone here has already entered into Raghunuga Bhakti. But for the most of us who are still practicing according to rules and regulations, these rules and regulations are obtained from the Shastra. We hear them from our gurus, but the gurus, they get them from the Shastras. So the basic repository of the regulations, the rules of devotional service and practice are there in the Shrutis, the Smritis, the Pancharatrika, and so on. These Shastra scriptures. And devotees who don't care to follow the rules, who ignore the prescriptions of these scriptures, they may be performing what they think is very elevated pure devotional service, but it's just utpata, a disturbance to the serious devotees. So when you're a sahaja, not only are you failing to really please Krishna, you may be dressing up like a gopi, but Krishna's not very interested in dancing with you. No, not yet. Yeah. But also, not only are you, you know, an annoyance to Krishna, or something he's not interested in, he doesn't want to even look at you, yeah, but you become a disturbance to other devotees. Yeah. One main way to do it is to set a bad example and bring others under your influence, and they also become sahajas. Now, this is a disservice to devotees, to set a bad example. So neither should we be complacent that we can remain in ignorance and just get Krishna's mercy and the mercy of the Vaishnavas without learning about the actual philosophy of Krishna consciousness, without acquiring proper understanding of what we're trying to do in this process. That is a deficient variety of devotion. And being proud of the little knowledge and the little experience we have and presuming that we're much more advanced than we are is also very dangerous. We have to remain in the middle. You know, we're trying to serve Krishna, and we should understand the process. We should understand who Krishna is and what the process of serving him is. And we should be enthusiastically trying to engage in his service. Not thinking that we're nothing and not thinking that we're everything. We're something in the middle. Where there are many devotees greater than us, and there are some devotees who are even worse than myself, believe it or not. You know, everybody except for God on one end. Everyone else, and then maybe there's a last soul, the worst soul in the universe, who's on the bottom of the scale, whoever that is. Everyone else is in the middle, somewhere. Somewhere on the great chain of existence, this line or hierarchy. We're all better than someone else and worse than someone else. Yeah. You can't even think you're not the best of anything. You can't even think that you're the best of being worst. You can't even think that. We're just mediocre. We're just servants of Krishna, and we should be satisfied with that. Yeah, Krishna will make us happy. He'll glorify us, but we don't have to artificially glorify ourselves or degrade ourselves or denigrate ourselves. We're just Krishna's devotees. And we're very happy to be remembering his pastimes, sitting here in the Bhagavatam class, remembering how Krishna revealed the universe in his mouth on the pretext of having eaten some dirt in the backyard. Hare Krishna. So any questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
You can easily see somebody who likes to denigrate themselves. You know, people who are very self-centered, so therefore they're always denigrating themselves.
Yeah, because of egotism.
Because they're big egos, and they denigrate themselves a lot. But what about a more down-to-earth example for us? We don't generally see amongst ISKCON devotees and devotees, contemporary devotees of our own neighborhood, who are running around wearing gopi clothes. So is there another more practical example of people who are thinking they're very advanced and therefore claiming lots of credits for that?
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, we have certain codes of behavior in ISKCON that are understood. Like, we don't dress up like gopis in ISKCON. Yeah, I don't think anybody can get away with it. You got to leave ISKCON if you want to do that. Yeah, dress as a gopi. Or do other radical things. I mean, we're pretty conservative in ISKCON. You know, we all dress simple dhotis and, you know, we're not too flamboyant in our style of devotional service. But there are, yes, subtler forms of this sahaja deviation, of thinking you're much more advanced than you are. Without outwardly doing anything really crazy, you may just be thinking within yourself, I'm better than the other devotees. And how do you establish yourself, at least within your own mind, as better than everybody else? By seeing everybody else's faults. That's, you know, it's hard to actually make yourself better than you are. It's hard work to actually make yourself better than you are. The easy thing is to raise yourself by lowering everybody else. Yeah. Either just figure out in your mind how everyone's got inferiority, reasons for being worse than you, or else do something to drag them down, if you can. Yeah. Then you improve your position by worsening of the others' positions. That we do see that. Sometimes we see devotees who actively try to make other devotees come down. And more often we see devotees, I see it myself all the time, looking at the faults of others because it adds to your own score. This is wrong with him, and that's wrong with him, and I'm better than that. You know, easy to find examples of that. At least for me, I can just see it in myself all the time. You know, I'm not sneaking out at night dressed in a sari. You know, and I don't think I'm trying to stab anybody in the back, you know, actually trying to make anybody fall down or make anybody look bad. But I do am thinking all the time about the faults of others because that makes me better, you know, in comparison. That I'm doing all the time. So, if you look for the more subtle examples, you'll find plenty of them. Within ISKCON, you'll find them anywhere. It's hard to avoid. You have to really become pure to not be looking for the faults of others for the sake of making yourself better in comparison. Yeah, okay. I'm going to the end of the number. And it, okay.
One scholar, Karl Potter, he written a book called Presuppositions of Indian Philosophy. And in that book, he discusses what he calls leap philosophies.
Leap?
Leap philosophies.
Yes.
Which are, and the Sahaja tendency is an example of that, that it's much easier than actually purifying yourself. It's much easier to just convince yourself that you're already pure.
Yes.
And the Maya bodies also, you know, instead of actually becoming liberated, they just assume that everything's already all one, so there's no need to become liberated.
Yes.
And the Christians also, they have this tendency as well. That they, all you have to do is have faith in your Savior, and that's all you need to do, and you're already there. So we should be careful of this tendency also, leaf philosophy. It's a cheap way out of a lot of hard work.
That's what the word Sahaja means. They gave the term to themselves. I think maybe it was originally Buddhists, Bengali Buddhists. And then the Vaishnavas and others, they also took on this Sahaja term. It means easy.
Natural.
You know, the easy way. Natural and easy. You don't have to work hard. Here's the easy way to become perfect. We, sad to say, tell everybody you got to work hard. You got to work for Krishna, and you got to study, you know. And I mean, everyone has had enough of that. I mean, I went to school for so many years, and now I'm working a job, or I'm still in school, and now you're telling me I can join Krishna consciousness and I have to study more and work more. You know, that's, you know, that's severe, but that's what our process is: study and work. We're not going to, you know, just to attract people, tell them that it's easy and cheap. It's not. It's not easy. I'm sorry, Nityanandapur.
As I properly understood, you told us for us to think of ourselves as the really lowest on the list is not so natural.
Yes.
However, like, you know, in this, the song we sing, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu, he sings that there's no one else more fallen than me than for either the first candidate to be delivered.
Yes.
So it looks like the devotees, the siddhas, they see themselves as really lost on this. So how does that shift happens so that it becomes natural for them to think like that?
It's natural. It's natural for the best person to think he's the worst. And he can, that can be, Krishna will tolerate that. If, when Narottam Das Thakur, Narottama, the best of human beings, best of men, says he's the worst, Krishna accepts it. Just like in the story of Gopukumara in the second part of the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. He went to one devotee after another, telling him, you're the best of Krishna's devotees, you have the most favor. And that devotee, one after another, would argue with him, get angry and say, what do you mean I'm not the best? I've got so many faults. And it was natural. Indra, Shiva, Brahma, Prahlad, the Pandavas, they all said this. Yudhishthira, they all told Gopakumar, no, I'm not the best, I'm really bad. And this other devotee is much better than me. But when he finally got to Uddhava, who's one of the best devotees, he was, after he went to everybody else, he went to Uddhava, sent to Uddhava. Gopakumar, I'm sorry, that's the story of Narada. Narada, the first part. Yeah, it's Narada going around, not Gopakumar. Narada gave the same presentation to Uddhava. Yes, you're the greatest of Krishna's devotees. And he listed the reasons why Uddhava is better than everyone else. And Uddhava said, yes, that may be true. But, see, Uddhava, when he got to that level, Uddhava didn't go out of his way to deny, okay, I have Krishna's favor. Yes, I have Krishna's favor. Krishna really loves me, and I'm his best friend. He accepted it. Because he has real humility. He doesn't have to make a show of rejecting any praise. He accepted the praise. But then said, but there's still somebody better than me. So I'm sorry, did I answer the question? Or?
No.
Can I rephrase this? Okay.
And then just
another
question. When Krishna shows universal form to Yashoda, what's his purpose? Like, he wants to test her Vatsalya, or he wants to glorify her by showing how she forgets him as Supreme Lord.
Both, and probably half a dozen other reasons too. Krishna's, you know, accomplishes multiple purposes with each of the things he does. And especially these are recorded in history. They're public events. So Krishna does it for the benefit of others too. You know, we benefit by reading this pastime, by hearing and remembering it. There's something in it for us. To understand special position of Krishna's devotees. But it's all of the above and more. All those reasons Krishna does the pastime. First, Dhamma Harper?
That's okay.
You're satisfied?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Because I want to know all this philosophy that other sampradayas and just Prabhupada says that, but according to Bhagavad, we should take initiation. They first consider their original constitutional position. You are the peacock or Golok Vrindavan or something. They, and they give initiation and they say that you should be meditated upon that.
Yes.
And you will be achieved. What is the philosophy behind this?
The philosophy, well, this is a variety of initiation into the practice of devotional service in which you're told at the time of initiation what your eternal relationship or your eternal identity is and what relationship you have with Krishna. But this was established by devotees of Lord Chaitanya. It is a bona fide process. Gopal Guru and Dhyanachandra Goswami teach this Siddha Pranali. And maybe others. Bhaktivinoda. Okay, but that's later, but they established it. And even Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself took this initiation. You know, so it is bona fide. We're not against it in principle. But the disciple and the guru must both be very qualified to do this. You know, it must be an exceptional disciple who's told at the time of his initiation what his eternal relationship with Krishna is. I don't think I'm ready to hear that after 30 years, 32 years after being initiated. I'm not ready to know what my sarupa is. You know? When I stop behaving like a dog, then I'll be ready to hear it. You know? And even after 30 years of practicing, I'm not ready to hear it. But some exceptional disciple, at the time of initiation, he's ready to hear. That doesn't mean that he immediately assumes, but he knows in advance, you know, what personality he's gradually going to do. But he understands it's gradual development. Not that you start strutting around like a peacock immediately. You know, okay, I'm a peacock, but that's my future life. You know, it's a sober, qualified disciple who can handle this kind of initiation. And the guru has to be qualified. Can actually tell a disciple, know how to tell a disciple, be able to judge what a disciple's sarupa is. Anyway, as the time goes on, people become less and less qualified. Bhaktivinoda Thakur received and accepted that kind of initiation himself. But his son, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, forbade it. Spoke out against it, the Siddha Pranali. Because practically nobody, at least in the 20th century and 21st century and the other centuries that are going to come, practically no one's fit for this. No one's ready. What to speak of Siddha Pranali? We're practically not ready for Raghunuga practice at all. You know, maybe after many years we'll be ready for it. Because we're very fallen, and we become more and more fallen as Kali Yuga progresses. Therefore, the Siddha Pranali is not practical for the modern times. There may be some exceptions. Yeah, but we're not against it in principle. Okay? Yes, Prabhu?
I heard from some sources that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur once slapped Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. So I don't know if it is true or if...
I don't know about that. I don't. Where did he... Ace... Is that... I don't think they ever met. In fact, were they living at the same time? When did Ramakrishna?
Yeah, he would have been very young.
Yeah, they probably couldn't have met because Ramakrishna would have been very old, and Bhaktisiddhanta would have been very young, Yeah, I never heard this. I never heard of this. Anybody here hear of such a story?
So it's a false story.
It's probably, yeah, that one's probably not true. As a boy, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati did say some sharp things to various people. Yes, but I don't think that was one of them.
He was against Vivekananda's.
Yes?
Vivekananda's philosophy about it. He criticized
it. Oh, he criticized it. And Prabhupada criticizes it also. But I'd be careful if you're in a village in Bengal. You know, don't just start talking about against Vivekananda unless you want to get beaten up. Yeah, you have to be able to do it expertly.
I want to know the validity of this incident.
Yes.
I want to know if this incident is true or not.
About
the slapping of...
I doubt it. I don't think, because of the difference in age, I don't think it could have happened. And I never heard of it from anybody. Okay. Yes, bro.
I think it's an extrapolation of this story.
Oh, okay.
Of how Bhaktisiddhanta is the same everyone. Sometimes when he would be walking down the streets, he would see a Mayavadi.
Yeah.
Come up to them and slap them in the face and tell them, why are you preaching this nonsense?
Yes.
It wasn't specifically Ramakrishna.
It was just somebody on the street.
It is not in the official class lecture. That's why I'm asking.
Okay. Yeah, I think that was a mistake to say that. It didn't happen. Not like that. Yes, sir.
You began by speaking about how we cannot assume or we cannot be careful about our natural assumption that Krishna is an ordinary boy or
yes.
By frame of reference. We don't really have a frame of reference for Krishna's lila. The problem of Mayavada is that there's no descriptive, there's no distinct information about God.
Yes.
But at the same time, it seems like the problem is simply transposed into this realm, wherein if we're going to think of God, we have no alternative, really, but to consider transcendental duality in terms of what we've experienced in this world. So how do we get out of that?
Well, yeah. Well, we do have to learn about it through analogies, you know, upama. You know, Krishna's eyes are beautiful like blooming lotus petals, and his feet are red like you know, beautiful like lotuses. That's a metaphor. It's using something we know in the material world to try to begin understanding Krishna. So yes, our understanding of Krishna does have to begin analogously by comparison to things we do know. Most civilized human beings have some concept of God. You know, the Hindus all know about Narayana, and you know, everyone's, you know, they have an idea of God, and even if we're Christians or Jews, you know, we can, God is, you know, the great Jehovah, you know, and we have a concept of God. We, you know, we were worshipping God since our young age, some of us. So it's not that we're completely ignorant of what is God. We just take the knowledge you have and expand on it, you know. You're a Muslim and you've been told all your life, Allahu Akbar. Okay, God is great. Now we'll just add more to that. What is it about him that makes him great? You know, here's his lila with his mother. That makes him great. That he can do this, show the whole universe in his belly, and then make his mother, you know, and his mother then forgets about that. That's how God is great. Okay. And then push it up.
Okay, I think I got it formulated, my question. Was that sometimes, talking about this leap philosophy, is that sometimes in our own practice we take some leap or take some extra austerity or start doing some or different mentalities in that we're not able to maintain?
Yeah.
We fall back short.
Yes.
Like we fall back, and sometimes it seems that we degrade ourselves a little bit. But like for example, do some austerities of fasting, and then it comes time to eat.
Well, who told you to do that?
It's just the mind.
Yeah. So we're taking the mind as our guru, and coming up with whimsical ideas of what we should do. Better to follow the program that's given to us by higher authority than make up our own program. We usually, even with all good intentions, we usually get in trouble. Making up ideas about what austerities I should take and things I should do. You know, there are enough things we're told to do by higher authority that we don't have to make up so many extra things for ourselves.
we hear of the examples of the great acharyas. You know,
yes.
Of course, we may not try to imitate, but like, for example, they would eat so frugally, and they would...
But how'd they get the power to do that? They got the power to do that. The Goswamis had the power to do that because they strictly followed their gurus. No, they didn't get like that by being whimsical.
So you have to have like a specific instruction from the guru.
Yeah.
Like one example is in Prabhupada.
Just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told Jagadananda, don't dress nicely and don't eat nicely. You want to be a sannyasi? This is the... I think you told Jagadananda Pandit. Yeah. So instruction directly from his guru, from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, his Shiksha guru. Yeah. So if my guru tells me that, you know, don't eat grains. Prabhupada told some of his disciples, don't eat grains. Yeah. Then you won't get sick and you won't get lusty. Yeah. So some disciples get that direct instruction, and then they can and should follow it.
Because I was thinking there's so many instructions in Prabhupada's books that somehow do I fall short of following. Like, I mean, not the basic things are,
yes,
of course, following, but there's many things that he's, like certain qualities and certain mentalities and certain,
yes,
habits that I fall short.
Yes.
From doing that.
Yes.
So how do you, just by practice?
By practice. Abhyasena, vairagyena abhyasena cha.
Sometimes you'll fall short, sometimes you'll fail, sometimes you just continue.
Right, but we become perfect by practice. Mm-hmm. And also, two things Krishna recommends, not just abhyasa, because if you practice faultily, you can go on forever practicing, but doing it, you know, always making the same mistakes. So we also have to let go of our material attachments to whatever extent we're ready to do. Don't hold on to more than you have to. Give up everything material as soon as you're ready to do it. Don't hang on more than necessary, because we're trying to get out of this world. And for our practice to be successful, you have to, it's like the story of the parable of the wedding party, who hired a boat at night to get to the other side to go to the wedding. And they woke up in the morning and found the boat still on the other, in the same place, because no one, the boatmen had been rowing all night, but no one bothered to untie the rope that was tying into the dock. So we have to untie our ropes. We have to let loose our attachments to materialism, so that our practice, our rowing the boat, will give its correct, its full effect. Vairagyena cha. Abhyasa, practice, but also cultivation of renunciation. That means give up your attachments. Give them up. You're holding on to them. Don't blame anybody else. It's not your mother's fault, your wife's fault, anybody else. It's yours. Give it up. Yeah. Give up the... a specific example? Well, a devotee, a young devotee wants to join ISKCON, his parents are opposed. They want, why aren't you, you got to get married, you got to finish your education, get your career, we can't let you become a sadhu, you can do that when you're 80 years old. So, the problem apparently is the parents, the oppression of the parents. And I can use that as an excuse for not making advance in my devotional service. Or I can be better than that and see that I'm also attached. It's not just my parents' fault. I want this materialistic life. I don't want to have to live too simply. I'd like a nice house and a nice car and a beautiful wife and 15 children. I'd like that also. So I've got the attachments in me. Although apparently it's my parents and my wife and my children that are putting all this pressure on me. It's also coming from inside. So I should not artificially and prematurely abandon my responsibilities, but I have to work on my attachments on the inside. That's the important thing. That's vairagya. When I think and meditate on how the real purpose of my life is to surrender to Krishna. It doesn't matter if I have a nice house to live in and a lot of money. And I can't satisfy everybody in the material world. My business is to satisfy my guru and Krishna and to do something to benefit the fallen conditioned souls. So when you meditate like that, that's practicing Vairagya. You know, and even though the material, the external circumstances may still be very encumbering, you're practicing your Krishna consciousness and cultivating within a sense of renunciation, you'll be successful in the end. I'm sorry, that wasn't a very specific example, but it was a sort of, you know, it works like that. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, we'll stop here. Oh, I'm sorry, Purushottamo.
In India, they say that many acharyas, they come like Bhagavad Saptaha.
Yes.
And whenever the particular Leela comes, like for example, Prahlad Leela.
Yes.
They dress somehow like Narasimha Avatara and all people worship him. So is that alright? Is that okay? Or because you said no one should imitate and...
No, you can have a dramatic performance. And a devotee can dress up like even God. You know, we have also plays, and you know, one devotee, you know, gets, you know, is in the Sringadeva, he's got a lion mask, and you know, and you know, he rips apart Ranjakashi Pru and spills, you know, just, you know, spaghetti and ketchup, you know. So that's entertainment. There's, you know, that kind of transcendental entertainment is appropriate in the proper circumstances. But I don't think the Bhagavatam class should be more serious. I don't think Bhagavatam class should be all song and dance and drama. It should, you know, you sit down and speak the Bhagavatam. That's recitation of the Bhagavatam in the mode of goodness. At least we should try to come to the mode of goodness, even if we can't engage in transcendental. But making a spectacle out of the Bhagavatam recital, it's okay. But that's Bhagavatam recital in the mode of passion, where you make a big show, including, you know, music and drama.
Tamasha.
Yeah, big show, tamasha, a big spectacle. It's okay, but it's in the mode of passion. It's not the best kind of Bhagavatam recital. It's not evil, but it's not our style. You know, we don't have a Casio, you know, keyboard here and singing songs, you know, in between paragraphs. We're not doing that.
At the
yes.
same time, there is an element of worship there. It's not just entertainment, even if the entertainment value is what motivates most people to attend.
Yes.
It's explicitly intended as worship, and the actors are believed to be Swaroops, manifestations of the Supreme Godhead. Now, I'm aware of the Rasalila tradition in which even Prabhupada seemed to acquiesce.
Yes.
There was some validity to that practice, but as far as what he's talking about, I'm not really sure. Maybe you can comment further.
Well, I don't know about the idea that the performers assume the sarupa. I don't know if we can agree with that on a synoptic level, you know, philosophically. There is value. That spiritual entertainment can be very purifying. If the actors are pure devotees, especially. You know, to the degree that the actors are devotional and pure, it'll have a great impact on the audience. But I don't know about this idea of, you know, the person dressed up as God becomes, you know, assumes this roop, or the idea that the speaker of the sitting on the asana of the Bhagavad Saptaha is Vyasadeva, you know, is worshipped as Vyas. Yeah, we don't do that. Of course, we call it the Vyasasana, but you know, we don't say that so and so is Vyasadeva. It's just not our style. Okay, he's representative of Vyasadeva. But we don't. We just don't get into that level. Yeah, it's just not our mood. I won't say it's completely bogus. I wonder, though. I mean, you know, about assuming the sarupa. You know, transcendental drama, especially if done by pure devotees, will create a great effect on the general audience, and it can also be very valuable for rasika bhaktis, are the ones who benefit most from transcendental drama, the ones who have a spiritual taste. They're the ones who get the real benefit from transcendental performances. But in the books on drama written by Rupa Goswami and Kavi Karnapur, Drama and Poetry, they don't say that the actor is assuming the role. just the contrary. They say the actor is just doing a job. He's actually equal to a member of the audience. He doesn't actually have the rasa of the person whose role he's performing. Even, you know, what to speak of, he's acting, he's on the stage being God. Even if he's being a devotee on the stage, the actor is not in the same rasa. His experience of the rasa as the actor speaking the lines is just vicarious. He's getting some experience of someone else's rasa. And that's the same experience that the audience, educated audience, has. They're seeing, you know, pastimes in Madhurya Leela, where, and many of those devotees in the audience are not situated in Madhurya Leela, but they can experience something of it vicariously as a member of the audience. That's transcendental drama. And it's the same thing in reading transcendental poetry. You read about the experience of devotees who are in a relationship with Krishna other than your own relationship with Krishna. But you can still share their experience in a way. That's kavya rasa, as opposed to actual direct bhakti rasa. The second-hand experience of other devotees that you get in reading drama, reading poetry and seeing drama. But our theoreticians don't say that the actor assumes the sarupa of the person he's performing the role of.
It may, this grudge tradition may actually come from Narayan Bhakta.
Okay.
And, but his position is also not really very clear to me, at least, because he's not mentioned in the mainstream literature.
Okay.
And, or nor by Srila Prabhupada.
Even though he wrote a lot of books.
And is very much acclaimed and considered Gaudiya Vaishnava.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anything else? Okay, we'll stop now. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki Jai.